sorts of things that he believes in and propagates.
And why is it that so many people could believe this, though, that he could label the news, certain news channels fake news, and he was so hostile to the press?
Well, we've come into what's called the post-truth world, where it's no longer, is true that you necessarily accept, but it's what you believe is truth. In other words, if it fits in with your own prejudices and your own approach, then that's fine. That's the news and that's what you're going to put forward.
And so there's so many interesting questions then that this documentary could raise. Do you think there's any other points and strong themes that this documentary had?
Well, I felt like it could have gone further. It could have shown more Trump supporters, as I said. It could have been more revealing. But in terms of the points it made, for me, characters are such a huge part of it. And to see the dynamic, particularly between one of the husband and wife in Massachusetts, and she's a little bit more reserved about Trump and he's really gung-ho. And to see the difference between families and couples and generations and how they interpret politics and speak to each other about politics, I thought was really, really interesting.
And that's an interesting point, actually, not to defend Trump supporters, but you realise that they're human beings and not all of them are evil, but they have different motivations and grievances for voting in terms of the whole system and their fight, especially when it comes to finances, I think, in the documentary.
A lot of times I work a long day. I'm out of the house before my kids even get out of bed. And then when I come home, it's 6 o'clock at night, it's dark, you know, it's time to eat dinner and go to bed, basically. So if the economy got better and I was bringing more people and more work into my shop and I could delegate a little bit more, then I'd be able to spend more time with my family. That'd be huge. That would be huge for me. I'm doing okay for myself right now, but it would be even that much better, you know? I don't know. I think if when Hillary gets elected, and I think she's going to get elected because she's going to
cheat.
If she's going to raise the taxes on everybody, and healthcare right now is crushing us anyway, so I'm concerned that we're going to have a tough time making ends meet.
It's not right. And you know Hillary doesn't care about anything but her pockets.
Take that stupid hat off, man.
I will not take this hat off.
What contribution do you think they made to the documentary?
They brought an entertainment factor, I think, which is really important. There's nothing to say that documentaries about political subjects need to be entirely serious. And it was sort of dark humour, but just seeing the dynamic between them was really involving and entertaining. But it also showed, as I said earlier, that you can, within a couple, see different political views and see different strains and strengths, but also what worrying things that people might be influencing each other and perhaps voting in what they don't personally actually really believe in, they're being swayed.
Jonathan, would you agree with what Anna said?
Yeah, they were a fascinating family, and they raised two issues there in that which are really important. In other words, tax, because Trump was saying he was going to cut taxes particularly for the higher income earners, which would be attractive to business people. And the other thing was Obamacare. One of the huge things that really figured in the election was the cost of Obamacare. President Obama brought in a system where poor people had medical insurance.
Surely that's a good thing.
Great.
Of course,
but the Trumpers, on the other hand, were saying we're paying for all these people to do that. Very interesting point made by a number of people during the film is they were voting against someone rather than for someone. And that's why Hillary lost, even though, of course, she actually got more votes than Trump did in the popular vote.
About 2.9%.
But she was more unpopular than Trump was.
And does that expose flaws, then, I suppose, in the American voting system?
Well, to us in Britain, which we don't have a flawless system here either, but it does seem really weird that someone can win the popular vote but lose the presidency.
And indeed, and I just wanted to talk about the parallels actually between the UK and the US and theatrical aspect of the US. I was just wondering, is there a documentary of this sort that would be as fascinating in the UK as it would be to follow an American election? Do you think it would be as interesting?
Well, obviously Brexit docs are fascinating, aren't they? I mean, that's the closest thing we've had recently. You're right, though, the Americans do have a showy way about them. But goodness, look at reality TV shows in the UK. We've certainly got our fair share of big personalities. So I think good documentaries can always find them.
Yes. Oh, no, that's a good point, actually, indeed, as also that we can compare. And I suppose UK politics seems to be a bit more on the serious side, or perhaps not.
Well, it'd be very interesting. The next election, presumably, we will have Jeremy Corbyn leading the Labour Party into an election campaign, and there'll be a big focus on, is this a man who can be Prime Minister? Is this a man who can lead Labour Party to victory? Because the opinion polls at the moment are saying more or less the Conservatives and Labour equal pegging, which is bizarre when the government is doing things which are frankly difficult to support. Why isn't the opposition miles ahead? So there is a ground for a real mystery there. So perhaps some documentary maker could already be plotting the election coverage documentary of Election Day, whenever it's going to be.
Perhaps. And just going back to the documentary, as we near the end of this discussion now, actually, I just wanted to get, Anna, your final thoughts on this documentary, and also would you recommend it?
I don't think it's an earth-shattering documentary, but I think it's very, very interesting. And I think if you want a further insight into what motivated a lot of American people to place their vote a certain way, then it's well worth a watch.
And Jonathan, if I turn to you, your final thoughts on the film, yeah, would you recommend it?
When it first started, I thought, oh my goodness, we're going to watch this for an hour and 45 minutes, am I going to really be interested? But you do get interested in the characters, in the individual families. In fact, I was disappointed when it finished.
Mm. And we'll have to leave it there on that good note to end it on. Thanks very much for coming on. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. The head of the World Health Organization delivered a stark warning recently about the state of the coronavirus pandemic as the highly transmissible Omicron strain continued to rip through large swathes of the global population, posing the greatest threat to poor countries that have been denied access to vaccines. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading Holiday Omicron Wave Could Mean Overwhelmed Health Systems and More Deaths. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The head of the World Health Organization has delivered a stark warning about the state of the coronavirus pandemic as the highly transmissible Omicron strain continued to rip through large swathes of the global population, posing the greatest threat to poor countries that have been denied access to vaccines. There is now consistent evidence that Omicron is spreading significantly faster than the Delta variant. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom said during a media briefing, referring to the previously dominant COVID-19 strain, adding, "And it is more likely that the people who have been vaccinated or have recovered from COVID-19 could be infected or reinfected." Tedros voiced particular concern about the collision of Omicron and crowded holiday celebrations, which he said will lead to increased cases, overwhelmed health systems, and more deaths. Tedros noted more than 3.3 million people have lost their lives to COVID-19 this year, more deaths than from HIV, malaria, and tuberculosis combined in 2020. And still, COVID-19 continues to claim around 50,000 lives every week. That's not to mention the unreported deaths and the millions of excess deaths caused by disruptions to essential health services. All of us are sick of this pandemic. All of us want to spend time with friends and family. All of us want to get back to normal, he continued. The fastest way to do that is for all of us, leaders and individuals, to make the difficult decisions that must be made to protect ourselves and others. In some cases, that will mean canceling or delaying events, but an event canceled is better than a life canceled. The Omicron strain now accounts for nearly three-quarters of all new coronavirus cases in the United States of America, and recorded infections stemming from the variant are doubling every 2 to 3 days in the dozens of countries where its presence has been detected. Tedros observed recently, Africa is now facing a steep wave of infections driven largely by the Omicron variant. Just a month ago, Africa was reporting its lowest number of cases in 18 months. Last week, it reported the fourth highest number of cases in a single week so far. Reiterating his condemnation of vaccine apartheid, which has left billions without access to life-saving shots as rich nations swallow up much of the world's supply, Tedros said that if we are to end the pandemic in the coming year, we must end inequity by ensuring 70% of the population of every country is vaccinated by the middle of the next year. WHO warned last week that over a year and a half into the pandemic, more than 40 countries have been unable to vaccinate at least 10% of their populations, and nearly 100 countries have not reached the 40% threshold. Overall, according to our rolling data, just 7.6% of people in low-income nations have received at least one coronavirus vaccine dose. Omicron's rapid spread in the month since it was first detected by South African scientists has led some European countries to impose new public health restrictions to stem surging cases. While early data out of South Africa has sparked some cautious optimism that Omicron causes less severe diseases than other coronavirus variants, public health experts have warned that a massive spike in infections could swamp hospitals that are already at capacity, particularly in developing nations. It is probably unwise to sit back and think this is a mild variant. It's not going to cause severe disease, because I think with the numbers going up, all health systems are going to be under strain, Sumaya Suminston, the WHO's chief scientist, told journalists recently. Additionally, though preliminary research indicates that existing coronavirus vaccines are effective at preventing serious illness or death from Omicron, lack of vaccine access in poor countries could allow the strain to run rampant across much of the world, causing more deaths and potentially spawning new variants.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
London Breed, mayor of San Francisco, has declared a state of emergency in the drug-infested neighborhood of Tenderloin to clean up what she called its nasty streets. The district has long been known for the number of homeless people, drug users, and drug dealers on the streets. Breed believes this state of emergency would disrupt the illegal activity in the neighborhood and get people the treatment and support they need. London Breed's announcement broke with the liberal tradition and exposed the extent of the crisis plaguing the city's streets. But San Francisco isn't the only city reeling from violence and drugs. More than 100,000 Americans died this year from drug overdoses. The situation has become so dire that U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order last week to fight organized crime networks whose actions are impacting the country's public health.
The overreach of the government dictates what families can do when it comes down to disciplining their children and all of that. So now you see generations having passed without any type of structure. The family is decaying. And of course, this is something that is touted on the news wave, media, all of those different things. It's a consistent thing where families are being denigrated.
In the meantime, cities across the U.S. are setting their all-time high records for homicides, most of which involving firearms. The Texas city of Austin, for example, where gun control is lax, has reported 88 homicides in 2021, eclipsing the previous high of 59 that was reported in 1984. Austin is among the 9 cities that have broken their homicide records. The case in point is that they are not concentrated, but are all scattered around the U.S. map. stores across the U.S. have increasingly been coming under raids by mobs who have been collecting tens of thousands of dollars worth of cash and goods in recent weeks. Although most of the ransacked high-end stores are located in the U.S. state of California, similar incidents have been taking place elsewhere in the country too. Police statistics show that theft and larceny have been up about 88% compared to last year, with the overall crime rate standing at almost 52% higher in 2021. A recent study suggests that the crime rate in the underprivileged areas has jumped much higher compared to wealthier districts in the first 5 months of the coronavirus pandemic. Law enforcement officials reject the idea that the rise in the so-called smash-and-grab attacks has to do with the COVID-19 pandemic. Instead, they believe the police's permissive attitude toward theft and the holiday season have been the factors pushing the numbers.
And of course, this lawlessness is a result of things that are unjust, things that continue to happen, and righteous judgment is not being implemented or instituted. And so also to add to that, it's a departing of the morality, the values and everything that this country was supposed to have espoused to years ago has been changed.
Some also believe law enforcement's lack of resources has forced the police to deprioritize theft, while others blame a lack of political will to fight such offenses. All indications are suggesting that the current crime rates in the U.S. are likely to become a new normal.
An investigation into the confidential files of the U.S. military has revealed a shocking truth about the American air war in West Asia. The New York Times says it has reviewed over 1,300 documents from a hidden Pentagon archive. The report has shed more light on how the U.S. undercounted thousands of civilian deaths caused by its deeply flawed intelligence and faulty targeting in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. According to the military's count, over 1,600 civilians, many of them children, have died in U.S. air operations in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. And even though the Times does not give a figure, it does say that the military has drastically undercounted the tally. The U.S. has a history of conducting similar strikes in Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan out of the spotlight without accepting any responsibility while destroying the lives of civilians. New research from a London-based civilian harm monitoring group, Air Wars, showed that since 2001, at least 22,600 civilians were killed in U.S. strikes across various theaters, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan. The group said that the number of civilian deaths could be potentially as high as 48,000. The documents show that the U.S. forces conducted more than 50,000 airstrikes in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan over a five-year period. The majority of strikes were carried out without prior plans. The report also brings into question the Pentagon's claims of transparency and accountability. Based on the report, only a few assessments of faulty raids have been made public, and surprisingly, none have found any wrongdoing or led to disciplinary action. The U.S. military, from the terrorist CENTCOM to the Department of Defense, does not provide official estimates of civilian deaths, nor have they published such findings. They simply kill civilians and rarely offer compensation.
The lack of accountability, even in the way in which these crimes are being revealed, shows that this is accepted within the political establishment of the U.S. government today. And it has been, when you look at past wars and the incredible number of civilian casualties.
In its report, the New York Times reviewed cases in which civilians were killed, none of which resulted in an admission of wrongdoing. The report says poor or inadequate surveillance footage often contributed to deadly targeting failures. Most recently, 10 people were killed in a U.S. drone strike in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Washington initially claimed to have targeted terrorists, but later it was revealed that all the victims were civilians, including 7 children. Washington was forced to admit that the attack had been a tragic mistake, taking civilian lives. But eventually, it decided that no one would be punished for the erroneous strike. Also, the New York Times says it has visited nearly 100 casualty sites in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan and interviewed scores of survivors to compile the report. Even though many civilian survivors now have to live with disabilities that require expensive treatment, only fewer than a dozen have received compensation.
Well, just to say, it's also important to recognize that the only people who've ever been prosecuted for the drone strikes are those who revealed that drone strikes were going on and that they were targeting civilians. I'm speaking about Daniel Hale, now in prison for exposing U.S. civilian strikes, Julian Assange. There's a refusal to hold anyone accountable.
The U.S. has kept killing civilians with impunity and without accountability in various theaters. It also suppresses the leaked information about crimes it committed in those countries. For instance, its efforts to punish the WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, who caused Washington great embarrassment by disclosing confidential military and diplomatic records in 2010. These documents included classified military and diplomatic information, detailing U.S. bombing campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq, information about civilian deaths, and secret U.S. drone strikes in Yemen in face of American officials' denial. His case proves that Washington fears its misdeeds being revealed again. Scores of Palestinians have been injured by Israeli settlers in villages around the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank following a shooting near an illegal outpost in Homesh that left one settler dead and two wounded. Dozens of Israeli settlers attacked Qaryut village south of Nablus overnight. The attackers broke into many homes in the town and assaulted local families. Scores of Palestinians were injured in the process and moved to several hospitals in Nablus. According to the Palestinian media, the settlers also blocked the main highway connecting Nablus and Ramallah and attacked vehicles with Palestinian license plates with stones, causing damages to several cars. In reaction to the attacks, the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates called on the United Nations to promptly activate the international protection system for Palestinian civilians under Israeli occupation. It also called on the international community to pressure the Israeli regime into stopping acts of terrorism committed by settlers against Palestinians and their communities. The ministry held the regime of Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett fully and directly responsible for settler violence and terror, and warned against the dangerous repercussions of their acts on the status of the region. It is stressed that Israeli authorities are encouraging and protecting settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis. According to Israeli advocacy group B'Tselem, 2021 saw a rise in settler violence of 28.6% compared to last year. UN human rights experts have expressed alarm at the rising rate of violence directed by Israeli settlers toward Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territory. According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of the Humanitarian Affairs, already in the first 10 months of 2021, there have been 410 attacks by settlers against Palestinians. Four Palestinians were killed by settlers this year. Nearly 700,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank. All the settlements are illegal under international law, and the United Nations Security Council has condemned the settlement activities in several resolutions. Since occupying the West Bank, Israel has misappropriated more than 200,000 hectares of land there for its own purposes, including building and expanding settlements and paving roads for settlers. Some areas have been taken over by the regime issuing military orders, others through daily acts of settler violence. These two seemingly unrelated tracks are both forms of state violence. The Israeli apartheid regime and its representatives actively aid and abet the settlers' violence as part of a strategy to cement the takeover of Palestinian land.
The settlers and the uniformed soldiers work together, not without tensions, but they always support each other. and the settlers are used to carry out the particular kinds of attacks, burning trees, certain kinds of terror attacks, which the army prefers not to do. They shoot, they kill, but they protect the settlers 100% of the time. The settlers know this, and it gives them a sense of complete impunity.
Last week, the U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland and an Israeli minister who is responsible for police discussed the increase in settler violence against Palestinians. That drew rebukes from pro-settlement ministers and right-wing opposition lawmakers within the Israeli regime. Omer Bar-Lev later pushed back his critics, saying they were having difficulty looking in the mirror and that settler violence has become an issue on the international stage. But Israel's Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, jumped in to say it's just a marginal issue. In a tweet on Tuesday, he noted that there are marginal elements in every community, and they should be dealt with using all means. But we must not generalize about an entire community. The Combatants for Peace group, which brings together Israeli and Palestinian victims of violence, condemned Bennett for his Tuesday comments, charging that the Prime Minister had given full backing to depraved settler violence, which has reached new heights under his watch. The group added that Bennett gave a green light to the Wild West atmosphere in the territories. Also, an interview published on Wednesday revealed what Israeli Foreign Minister thinks about this issue. He told an American periodical earlier this month that extremist violence is a stain on Israel amid a noted rise in violent attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians.
There is a situation in the West Bank which is lawless. You might consider the situation to be one of no legal protection for Palestinians whatsoever.
Bennett's marginalization of the issue was aimed at legitimizing and praising settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis. Let's not forget that Israeli soldiers and police usually defend the attackers or simply stand to the side when they assault Palestinians. Therefore, settler violence is a central issue that requires urgent attention from the international community to put an end to it.
Morgan, Helen Margaret Lillian, Liberal Democrats, 17,957.
In another setback for the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, his Conservative Party has lost its North Shropshire seat to Liberal Democrats in a by-election, the constituency the Tories dominated for nearly 200 years. In her victory speech, Helen Morgan said the results reflect the British people's views about the Conservative Party.
Tonight, the people of North Shropshire have spoken on behalf of the British people. They've said loudly and clearly, Boris Johnson, the party is over.
The Liberal Democrats, in my view, have never been an alternative to the Conservative Party. They're really there's very little difference between the policies of the Liberal Democrats and Conservatives. In other words, when the Conservatives lose credibility, they bring out the Liberal Democrats, who are sort of centrist, never represented any concrete or coherent alternative to the Conservative Party.
Conservative lawmaker Roger Gale also says the by-election can be regarded as a referendum on the Prime Minister's performance. The by-election was called after the former MP for North Shropshire stepped down for breaching the Parliament's paid lobbying rules. The British government tried to avert the resignation by changing the rules, but later faced a backlash and was forced to backtrack. That was only one in the long list of issues raising questions about Boris Johnson's leadership. Opposition politicians accused Johnson of being a serial liar and incompetent leader, with some demanding that he resign.
Clearly, the vote in North Shropshire.
Boris Johnson acknowledged that the shocking results of the North Shropshire by-election contained a message for him and his party.
I'm responsible for everything that the government does, and of course I take personal responsibility.
But there's too much responsibility to shoulder, as Boris Johnson's tenure has been replete with a spate of allegations and scandals. The Premier stands accused of breaking the law by using Conservative Party donations to renovate his residence at number 11 Downing Street. is also under pressure for reported parties in his office last Christmas, disregarding the very COVID-19 restrictions the government had imposed. British dailies The Guardian and The Independent have also reported that Boris Johnson himself joined a pizza party in Downing Street in May last year amid the first nationwide lockdown. The Premier is also under fire for his handling of the pandemic. On Tuesday, he suffered a humiliating rebellion from Conservative lawmakers over measures to curb the spread of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. In addition, damaging disclosures have surfaced about some of the Conservative MPs who've moonlighted as political consultants or advisors, raking in tens of thousands of pounds by lobbying. The metaphorical pendulum in Britain's domestic politics appears to be swinging to the other side. The Conservatives have a couple of years to stop that from happening.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. A record 1.7 million migrants from around the world, many of them fleeing pandemic-ravaged countries, were encountered trying to enter the United States illegally in the last 12 months. Capping a year of chaos at the southern border with Mexico, which has emerged as one of the most formidable challenges for the Biden administration. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Eileen Sullivan and Miriam Jordan. The piece is titled, Illegal Border Crossings Driven by Pandemic and Natural Disasters Soar to Record High. Record 1.7 million migrants from around the world, many of them fleeing pandemic-ravaged countries, were encountered trying to enter the United States illegally in the last 12 months, capping a year of chaos at the southern border with Mexico, which has emerged as one of the most formidable challenges for the Biden administration. It was the highest number of illegal crossings recorded since at least 1960, when the U.S. government first began tracking such entries. The number was similarly high for the 2000 fiscal year, when border agents caught 1.6 million people, according to government data. Single adults represented the largest group of those detained in the fiscal year that ended on 30th of September, at 1.1 million, or 64% of all crossers. There were also large numbers of migrant families, more than 479,000, which is about 48,000 fewer than during the last surge in family crossings in 2019. But the nearly 147,000 children whom border agents encountered without parents or guardians was the largest number since 2008, when the government started tallying unaccompanied minors. Finding shelter for these migrant children until they can be released to relatives or other sponsors in the country was one of President Biden's earliest challenges. As of Friday, 22nd of October, nearly 11,000 remained in government custody. The crossers hailed from around the globe, many of them seeking economic opportunity as the coronavirus pandemic erased hundreds of millions of jobs. Border agents caught people from more than 160 countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, with Mexico accounting for the largest share. A public health rule invoked by President Donald J. Trump at the beginning of the pandemic in 2020 to seal the border has remained in place under the Biden administration. Over the last 12 months, the Border Patrol has carried out more than 1 million expulsions of migrants back to Mexico or to the migrants' home countries. Agents use the public health rule to expel migrants they encountered 61% of the time and to expel families 26% of the time. President Biden has walked a fine line between trying to control the influx and put in place a more humane approach to border enforcement. Republicans have blamed President Biden's promises to reverse Trump-era immigration policies for fueling the surge, as word spread that the country's borders had become easier to breach. What we're seeing at the southern border is a crisis, Mike Pompeo, a former U.S. Secretary of State under Donald Trump, said on Twitter on Friday afternoon, 22nd of October. If the Biden administration would have kept the policies we had in place, this would have never have happened. In particular, Republican lawmakers have been sharply critical of the admission of tens of thousands of unaccompanied children, along with many families, who would have been turned back under the Trump administration. The Border Patrol released nearly 250,000 migrants into the country, including some with instructions to appear before an immigration judge for removal proceedings, according to Customs and Border Protection, CBP. Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas, called on Friday for the Biden administration to declare a national emergency on the southern border with Mexico. The crossings this year followed a relative lull in 2020, when just over 400,000 people were encountered trying to enter the country illegally. The drop was largely attributed to the pandemic's impact on international travel, which kept migrants leaving far-flung countries from reaching Mexico, their entry point to the United States. Even as the Biden administration continues to use the Trump-era public health rule to deter migration, people from Mexico and the Northern Triangle countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, have crossed without authorization in high numbers for several consecutive months. In addition to the pandemic, two hurricanes destroyed livelihoods and homes in Guatemala and in Honduras, where extortion and violence from gangs have persisted in many communities, further fueling an exodus. The sustained increase has led to overcrowding and sometimes chaos at processing centers along the southern border with Mexico, where migrants must be held until the U.S. authorities have conducted background checks and entered every single person into a computer. More than 655,000 Mexicans were arrested, the most from any one country, according to the latest data, along with a combined total of more than 700,000 from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Together, migrants from Mexico and Central America represented 78% of the total. Over the past year, there was a significant jump in the number of migrants, mostly families from Brazil, which has been in the grips of the worst COVID crisis in South America. More migrants also arrived from Venezuela, from Nicaragua, and from India, among many others. Southern border apprehensions previously reached such high levels in the late 1990s, peaking in 2000, when many migrants who entered the country unlawfully were drawn to jobs in construction industry, food processing, and restaurants. As in the past year, most of those who entered were single adults from Mexico. Many of them tried more than once to sneak into the country, usually until they succeeded, because they did not face significant legal consequences, said Jessica Bolter, an analyst with the Migration Policy Institute. She added that there were lots of incentives for migrants to try to cross over and over. When the Trump administration first invoked the current public health rule, known as Title 42, officials said it was needed to avoid the spread of the coronavirus in the United States. But it has had the unintended consequence of encouraging hundreds of thousands of desperate people to make repeated attempts to enter the country. Many of those subjected to the rule are expeditiously returned to Mexico, often by bus, only to try again just a few days later. Before the public health rule was put in place at the beginning of the pandemic, migrants caught entering the country without authorization could be criminally prosecuted and detained for months. In September, about 25% of arrests were of repeat crossers. The high rate of recidivism suggests the majority of border crossers in recent years have been caught, which was not the case during previous peaks. The number of Border Patrol agents has increased substantially in the last decade, and technology like heat sensors, cameras, and drones make it difficult to evade capture. There were not nearly as many agents, they had little technology, and there were a lot of easy places to cross, said Jeff Passel, a demographer at the nonpartisan Pew Research Center who studies the population of those who enter without authorization. Data shows the Border Patrol now catch almost everybody who tries to cross illegally. When President Joe Biden took office, the administration was aware of an uptick in the number of migrants heading north, but it appeared to be caught flat-footed by the large jump in the numbers that followed and by how long the trend has lasted. The data released on Friday, 22nd of October, also shows a sharp increase in the number of Haitian migrants who crossed last month, more than 17,000, or 38% of the total number of Haitians who were caught crossing illegally over the past 12 months. The Biden administration's response to their arrival in high numbers in Del Rio, Texas, has drawn broad criticism and raised concerns over the mistreatment of black migrants in particular. Of the Haitians who crossed in September, 36% were turned away under the public health rule, including more than 2,500 who had arrived in family units. In all, the Biden administration used the rule to turn away 54% of all the migrants caught crossing illegally last month. To comply with a recent court order, the Biden administration has said it plans next month to resume a Trump-era policy known as Remain in Mexico, which mandates that asylum seekers wait in Mexico for their immigration court hearings in the United States, pending agreement from the Mexican government. The administration, early this year, had ended the program, which accounts for some of the increase in crossings this year. The program has been criticized for subjecting thousands of migrant families to violence, including kidnappings for ransom in Mexican border towns controlled by drug cartels.
Thank you. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres landed in Beirut on Sunday to follow up several issues, including Lebanon's economic crisis. In a press conference, he described as saddening and heartbreaking the situation in Lebanon.
I am also gravely concerned about the impact of the economic and financial crisis in the country, causing ever more people to need humanitarian assistance. Yesterday, I visited Tripoli in North Lebanon and today Tyre in the south. And I was very moved when listening to first-hand testimonies about the crisis is impacting people's daily lives.
During his visit, the United Nations chief met President Michel Aoun and stressed that the United Nations stands in solidarity with Lebanon in its crisis. After meeting with Speaker Nabih Berri, the head of the UN recognized the Israeli violations of Lebanon's airspace.
The opportunity to discuss the presence of UNIFIL in southern Lebanon, the need to end with all violations of the ceasefire, and in particular, the speaker has drawn my attention to the violations of the airspace of Lebanon, and also the need for total implementation of the resolutions of the Security Council.
The UN chief called on the Lebanese political leaders to show unity in order to carry out fundamental reforms, continue talks with the International Monetary Fund. Analysts question whether the UN can have any tangible impact on the situation in Lebanon in light of U.S. sanctions and Israeli violations.
The question we need to ask today is, can the UN change the reality on the ground, especially since there are U.S. economic sanctions and there are daily Israeli violations against Lebanon? Up until now, we have not seen any practical measures from the UN to at least stop these violations and the injustice which the Lebanese people are subject to because of its support for the resistance and its fight to have full sovereignty over its country.
Guterres also visited Prime Minister Najib Mikati and lauded Lebanon's generosity in being a place where Syrians and Palestinians took refuge.
The United Nations chief urged the international community to provide more financial assistance to Lebanon, which is grappling with a myriad of crises, especially an unprecedented economic collapse. Yet most Lebanese doubt that these words would be translated into measures to stop U.S. sanctions against Lebanon. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
In recent weeks, tensions between Russia on one side and Ukraine and the US and NATO on the other have reached an alarming new level, raising fears of an armed conflict. The two sides have time and time again accused each other of provoking a military escalation in Ukraine and warned of serious consequences. In the latest development, the Russian president has blamed the West for escalating tensions in Europe, citing NATO's eastward expansion and the US withdrawal from missile treaties like the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty and the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. The Russian leader has also warned that his country is prepared to take military technical measures in response to unfriendly Western actions over Ukraine.
Russia stands for equal and indivisible security throughout the Eurasian area. Of course, as I have already noted, if our Western colleagues continue their aggressive course of action, we will take adequate military and technical actions in response. We will react toughly to unfriendly steps. And I want to emphasize, we have every right to do so. We have every right to take actions aimed at ensuring the security and sovereignty of Russia.
The warning comes as the US and its European allies have stepped up their anti-Russia rhetoric under the pretext that Moscow is building up its troops to invade Ukraine. Russia argues that it's the US and NATO that are infringing upon it with an eastward expansion and by arming Ukraine under false excuses. Russia has also demanded legal security guarantees regarding the situation around Ukraine. In the draft security pacts published on Friday, Russia urged NATO to give up any military activity in Eastern Europe and Ukraine and roll back the deployment of its troops and weapons. However, many experts have cast doubt on the possibility of reaching an agreement between the US and Russia, saying even if Washington accepts such terms, there is still no guarantee that it remains committed to them.
If we look at it contemporarily, US promises and guarantees and even signed treaties and negotiations mean nothing. I mean, Iran knows this with the JCPOA, the different nuclear treaties which have been violated by the United States unilaterally. So these are worthless, and I doubt that they will actually make any agreement.
The United States, especially under the presidency of Joe Biden, has made its best efforts to provide military support to Ukraine, which lies on Russia's doorstep. In September, Washington signed a new cooperation agreement in the field of defense and security with Kiev. In the meantime, the U.S. is training military personnel in the Eastern European country, upgrading the country's ports to fit its warships and supplying it annually with hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid. The Biden administration's policies show that Washington is trying to keep tensions escalating to reduce Russia's influence in Eastern Europe, and Ukraine seems to be the best place to aim this goal. Russia, on the other hand, argues that while Ukraine is free to decide the security arrangements, those cannot threaten Russia's interests and security, insisting that Ukraine joining the NATO military alliance would cross a red line. As tensions between Russia and NATO over Ukraine are escalating, there are serious concerns about the potential for military escalation, potentially to the point of full-blown war.
Divine verses are recited by the most euphonious voices, and the best recitations will win the award of the 44th Quran competition in Iran. 200 contestants are competing in the Quranic event in two sections of female and male competitions and in seven different fields, including recitation, memorization, and interpretation.
Last year, the competition was held online due to pandemic. I'm so happy that this year it's being held physically. I'm competing in recitation section and I hope I will win the contest.
The Holy Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad some 14 centuries ago to teach humanity how to live in peace. It preaches us against any kind of discrimination and intolerance. So it's good to recite the Quran with a beautiful voice and win a prize here in this contest. But at the same time, we need to pay attention to the divine instructions in order to benefit from this holy book.
The event is organized by the Endowment and Charity Affairs Organization. It says one of the major goals of this competition is to encourage the youth to keep their touch with the holy book of Quran at a time when technology has distracted societies from religious teachings.
The average age of the participants in the contest is below 30 years. This is very promising and shows that previous editions of the competition have been successful in attracting the youth and teens to the Holy Quran and its rich instructions.
The Quranic contest is held at a national scale, but at the same time, it's a preparatory stage for the International Quran Competition, which will be held next year in Iran, where finalists of this event will compete with international contestants.
Every Muslim family has the Holy Quran in their houses to read its verses and ponder its divine messages to mankind. Messages that can leave a deeper impact on listeners through these melodious recitations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The sights and smells of home, from Palestinian traditional clothes to signature Palestinian dishes. Roughly 6 million Palestinians live in exile after 73 years of illegal Israeli occupation, which denies them the right to return.
Events like this bring together Palestinians from all walks of life.
But the main target is the younger generation.